Hi, y'all. We are back for another episode, and I actually have two special guests today, and I'm so excited for this conversation. I have Jesse Ginsberg and Chris Winger here on the podcast. You might know them on social media as the Sensory SLP and Speech Dude, and I'm just so excited to be able to have a conversation about what neurodivergent affirming speech therapy can look like. Welcome to a parenting space actually designed for you, where you can get answers about navigating a life that includes autism. I'm Dr. Tay, a licensed child psychologist and parental coach specializing in neurodivergent affirming care. I have supported hundreds of autistic children and their families and have been in the autism field for over a decade. And I know firsthand the impact autism can have. I was 12 years old when my little brother was diagnosed and my family had to learn how to navigate the autism journey. It wasn't always easy. 2 decades later, I now create resources and services I wish my family had, including this podcast, and I developed the whole family approach. On this podcast, of course, we will talk about autism, but we will also talk about your personal growth and well-being as a parent, supporting your non-autistic children, and sharing personal stories of other families so you know you're not alone. Quick disclaimer before we jump into today's episode. Anything shared on this podcast should not be considered clinical advice, and you should consult with your team of medical, mental health, and developmental providers if you need support. So welcome. So glad to have both of you on the podcast today.
Thank you. We're excited. Yeah, absolutely. This is our passion. This is our journey forward, liking to make shift with neurodiversity affirming strategies and ideas to really make change moving forward.
Yep. Absolutely. And because we're together every day, this is our pillow talk. This is what we eat for breakfast. This is our life.
It is, honestly.
So, Chris, why don't you kick us off? Tell us how you got into the field broadly, being a speech language pathologist, but then specifically really focusing on neurodiversity and working with autistic learners.
Yeah. So my journey has been somewhat interesting. I grew up with parents that were in education. So my dad always encouraged me to go down the path and of getting into education, working as a teacher. And so he worked a lot with the adaptive PE program. That was what he did, was he worked as a PE teacher. And so I would join him when I graduated as a sub. And that was my first step into education. I pursued a master's degree in special education and started off teaching. So I got really familiar with writing IEPs. This is like way back in the day, the late 90s, where you used to have to handwrite them. Now it's all digital. But it was nice when we had handwritten IEPs because you could literally see the ink marks of change.
Yeah, you could erase and be like, no, I did not say that.
I didn't say that. I'm erasing that one. Where's the whiteout? IEPs had whiteout. It was like the little whiteout tape, the strips.
Oh, yeah.
That happened back in the day. But yeah, so the speech therapist at the time on my campus was calling out students. He'd say, hey, Mr. Winger, could I get 2 students from your class? And I'd be like, do you want all of the students? What's going on? I want to work with just 2 students. And so I shadowed him a little bit. And that is what really brought me into the speech world. I was like, man, I would love to be able to work with smaller groups, working with that social connection with peers and friendships. And then, so that's how I journeyed into speech therapy. Back in, gosh, I want to say it was around like 2005 to 2007. Around that time, I really got into this author, Daniel Pink, and his big drive at that time, he wrote a book called Drive, and it was all about intrinsic motivation. And so about 20 years ago, that became my area of interest. How do I get away from external rewards and external motivators? And how can I use in my therapy intrinsic motivation? How can I build on autonomy and mastery and purpose and all of these areas of how life just works on a large scale? So that was before I knew the term neurodiversity affirming. I've been doing it for 20 years on coming from Daniel Pink's work of how do we create a setting where students can have more autonomy, more control over their own IEP, more say in what we're writing for their goals, and structuring goals that were for them, not for the classroom setting, right? And we've seen that for so long. It's like, how do we get this kid from not interrupting in the class or staying seated? And it's whose goal is that for? That's not for the student. So It's always been like, how do we get this kid regulated? How do we get this kid the ability to advocate for their accommodations? And so that has been my journey forward for quite some time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really cool to see how ahead of the game you were. So it makes sense that you became a voice in all of this. I remember finding both of your accounts, like when I was newer to this. So I graduated with my PhD in 2020, and this is not how I was trained whatsoever. And I was in academia, and I remember stumbling on both of your accounts being like, okay. And then also, of course, going to Autistic Voices and really learning from them as well. So what about you, Jesse? How did you get into this field and start doing this work?
Yeah, it's funny because as I was listening to you, I was thinking, I feel like I've never really made the connection that our roots were so similar, because when I got started in this field, I was initially trained to be a floor time therapist. So that really, for anyone who doesn't know, helps to really harness kids' intrinsic motivation and build skills from there. And big focus on developing relationships and connections and using that to build language. And I was trained by a mentee of Dr. Greenspan, who was the creator of the floor time approach. And when I was looking for my clinical fellowships after grad school, I applied to the Floor Time Center, which Stanley Greenspan had passed away by this time, but his son, Jake, ran and still runs the Floor Time Center. And I interviewed with them a bunch of times, went in on the East Coast and met them. And then I got an offer from them, which I turned down. And I had this freak out moment where I was like, oh my God, I don't think I can work with only autistic kids. It's going to be, I don't feel confident enough in my skills to do this. Mm. And it's just funny because I had learned a lot because I'd been a floor time therapist. So I took another job. I stayed in touch with Jake, and my new job had seen that I knew a lot about working with autistic kids. They asked me to do a full training for their clinic. The next year, Jake and I were presenting together at the National Conference for Speech Therapists on building motivation. Ooh. And yeah, we ended up speaking together again after that. And it's just funny because that was my whole drive too, was that how can we make this more intrinsically motivating for kids? And ironically, after I graduated, I had also worked as a behavioral therapist for a year. So I really got to see the difference because I was just doing what I was taught when I was taking that job. I had no prior experience in that type of therapy. It was all based on reward systems and being in school as this girl's one-on-one aide and having her work for a sensory break, having her work for anything. So I got to see a major difference. And there was this girl I was seeing, and I would be doing everything I was taught, like telling her quiet hands, telling her quiet mouth, trying to keep her still in class so she didn't distract her peers. And then recess would come around and I'd be like, no one gave me instructions for this. I'm gonna do whatever I want. And I'd swing with her and I'd sing with her and I'd put her on my lap and we'd spin around in the office chair that they had in the classroom. And my passion became that, how can I get more moments like this where the child is intrinsically motivated to engage with me and wants to learn because it's fun and it's exciting and not because they're going to get something for it.
Right. So wait, I'm a little curious. I've wondered this just following along your account, Jesse. Then how did you learn all of these sensory approaches? I think I heard you say at one point, like you basically like deep dove into the OT field. Yeah. Talk a little bit about that.
So I first learned about sensory when I was an SLP assistant, which is when I was a floor time therapist. So that was my very first job. And I would do co-treats with the OTs. And there were just kids. There's this one boy, and this was so long ago, and it's, you never forget some of these moments with your kids. But there was this boy I would see, and he would come in. He was about 3. And it was like he would play with the stuff I would put in front of him, but he just didn't seem excited. I was like, he seemed almost indifferent. Yeah, I'm here. Meh. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I feel like there's so much potential in this boy and I'm just not seeing it. And one day his OT said, let's do a co-treat and we could bring him in the gym. And we put him on the swing and she pushed him. And it was like, I could literally just see a complete difference change in his eyes. Like his eyes brightened. It was like a light switch turning on. And it was just that he was understimulated in my therapy room. And then the moment we took him into the gym and we gave him this intense sensory input, all of a sudden he was answering all the WH questions. I had that goal for him. And I was seeing all of this language and enthusiasm and excitement. And there's just, it was periods like that and kids like that where I really realized what regulation can do for our speech and language. I didn't even remember this until maybe a couple years ago, someone was asking me about it, but I wrote about that boy for my grad school essay. Oh, wow. And when I was applying for school, I said, this is what I want my specialty to be, sensory and speech. And it was like, I forgot about that for years because then I went into grad school and the stress of this and that. And eventually it all came back. But I did spend a year and a half in an OT program for sensory, along with doing a lot of other, I've hired OTs in my clinic before. So I've gotten to work a lot firsthand as well. And so much reading, researching, all the good stuff that you know a lot about.
No, that's so cool. Okay. A personal question. I'm curious, how did the two of you meet then? Because you obviously have such overlapping interests professionally. Like, how did this come together?
Yeah. So I had signed up for a Bumble account. No, I'm just kidding. because our worlds do overlap. And It was because of that. I was a director in the county that I work in right now. And then Jesse was a director for our state organization for a different county. So we just over time got to just know each other at our board meetings and started just sharing ideas. And then, just as life journeyed forward.
Yeah, we had this huge overlap, obviously, in interest in autism. And there got to a point where I was like, oh, we should speak together at the conference or we should do something together. So then we started like meeting to do that. And then meetings turned to dates. And now we have two kids.
Yeah.
Along with my other two. So family, four boys and us.
So fun. So fun. So do you guys talk about this a lot at home then? Do you guys find yourself or are you able to shut off? I'm just curious.
No.
So the greatest part, honestly, is that the strategies that we work with in our office settings with our clients, with our students, are the same strategies that we do at home, which is really cool because we can see it firsthand on what drives that internal motivation, what helps regulate, what helps us co-regulate. I think as parents and as clinicians, there's that major theme of the very first thing we do is work on our own nervous system regulation, right? In all contexts. So when we could come from that angle, whether it's as a parent or a clinician in a setting, then we can go to the next step. But that's always number one. Her and I are always, if I find myself starting to get to the tipping point, I'm like, Jesse, right now I'm not very regulated. I got to go to the kitchen before I lose it. And then we just work on our strategies to.
But yeah. I'm the one who says that more often than him. But no, we have one of our kids has some sensory sensitivities, some demand avoidance,
some need
AKA
for autonomy.
Drive for autonomy.
Okay.
Some anxiety. One of our other kids is like extremely active, like definitely inherited dad's ADHD gene. And there's a lot we have to practice what we preach every single day.
Every day.
But to answer your question, no, it does not turn off. Like there are plenty of times where I'm going out to get a glass of water at 9 o'clock and then he's at his computer and he's, oh, can you take a look at this goal I just wrote? I'm like, but it's time for The Bachelor. Can we do this in an hour?
So I get all my goal writing done during Bachelor and Love is Blind.
I love it. Oh, that's so good. That's so good. So a parent's listening to this and they're like, okay, cool hearing about this, but my kid goes to speech either in a school setting, outpatient, is sitting at a table, but we're not seeing lots of progress. Where do you often recommend families start in shifting that and what they should look for that might be a better match?
It's so interesting because part of my role in my clinic is I do all of our phone calls for new families, and I've given it up in the past. I've go on and off years where I give it up. And then I just love doing it so much and I end up taking it back.
Yeah.
So I spent at least an hour a day on the phone with families looking for therapy. And it's the number one indicator that a family should be finding a new therapist or a new approach is that what they're doing doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like a good fit. And I can't tell you how often I hear that from families. They just say, I just don't know. Yes, they're not really progressing, but also it just doesn't feel like the right fit. And I think that's more important than anything that we do. We trust our gut, because the thing is, when you are working with a neurodiversity affirming provider, it will feel good.
Mm-hmm.
That's the simplest way that I can put it, because you know that you are giving the child what they need. You are building on their strengths, but you are supporting them in areas where you want them to grow.
Yeah.
And to most parents, they come in, they might cry their first time leaving the clinic because they're like, oh my God, I feel like I found the place. You guys get my kid.
Mm-hmm.
We just had this family and this mom came in and they're driving. We have families who drive like an hour to come for a 30-minute session because that's how hard it is to find the provider they need. So we had this family who drive from an hour to come for their session. And it was maybe the boy's second or third time coming. He's 3, I want to say maybe 4. And she was in the waiting room and he saw his therapist and he just runs back. And he left mom and he left all of his stuffed animals. He had brought these 4 massive stuffed animals that he takes everywhere. And I was in the waiting room with her and she just started crying. She's just, I've never seen him do that before. He always needs me and he needs his comfort items. And so parents feel safe, kids feel safe, and they all feel good.
Yeah. No, I would shadow that. That was exactly how I would have answered that is you just have your intuition as a parent and you just have this feeling and you know if it's working or if it's right, or you also know, hey, this just doesn't feel right. And I always think about that, the cost benefit for any kind of therapy. So not just for speech therapy, but any kind of therapy. If the therapy causes more dysregulation or impact on the nervous system than what the therapy is supposed to do, then we have to keep in mind the nervous system safety first.
Right.
Because if we just continue forcing speech therapy and occupational therapy and whatever other kinds of therapy are there and slowly start building up that threshold of, and then going beyond it, then the kid's going to end up in burnout. And then by the time they get to be a teenager, which is the students I work with, they don't want to go to school. They're completely shut down. They're in burnout. And then that's where we see what is referred to sometimes as regression, but I don't see it as regression. I just see it as, hey, burnout. We've maxed out the nervous system and now we've got to try to get back out of that by getting back to outside of the lower part of the brain and up towards the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah. And I'm seeing that right now with like preschoolers and like early elementary age kids too, of this burnout is happening even sooner. And I think sometimes it's interesting. Like I have a family of a 4-year-old right now who is in this like autistic burnout, has the PDA profile, and mom's, what do we do? And I'm like, you need to cut back on the amount of therapies. Like it's drive time and then getting out of the car is so dysregulating and then not having affirming therapists. And I think at first mom was, it's scary, right? Because many of the messages say like you need the hours, you need the services. And it's so much quality over quantity that I think really has to be at the center of all of this.
Oh my gosh, you nailed it. That is exactly right. Yeah, because once a child gets into burnout, it can take quite some time to get out of burnout.
Yeah.
And then, exactly what you were saying, you just get lower demands and try to get them out of there.
Yeah. So Chris, I'm curious from your perspective, one thing I find as a provider, but I also hear from parents quite a bit, is they've learned about neurodiversity. They're using affirming approaches. Maybe even their outpatient team is using affirming approaches, but then getting the school on board with this approach, they're feeling a lot of resistance. Do you have any tips of like how to navigate this with the SLP in school or even like any of the providers really that maybe just aren't in the know yet?
Real quick, just a brief interruption, because I want you to know you don't have to navigate this journey alone.
If you're in a place where you have concerns about your child's development, you've been on the search for a therapist that provides evidence-informed neurodivergent affirming care, or you're needing more support as a parent, the whole family approach may be a good fit for you. Autism doesn't just impact your child's life, so you deserve care that works for your child and your whole family. Head to the link in the show notes to schedule a complimentary call where we can chat about your unique circumstances. We can help you decide if Dr. Tay, concierge clinical care, would be a good fit for your family. And if not, we will provide you resources for your next best steps.
Yeah, gosh, there's so much, because the IEP that the students are on is their individualized education plan that we can shape and reframe to think about how can we prioritize mental health and well-being. And that's the starting point for me. So it's not, how do I get this, as I mentioned earlier, it's not about how do I benefit the teacher or the school. How do I provide purpose and benefit for the student, because that student needs these same skills beyond the classroom setting and beyond the school walls. And so I always try to think about educating the team with the language, and that could be on the parent's frame too, by saying things such as, my child really thrives when they feel a connection with the teacher, with the paraeducator. They do well when they get some choices. And then one of the things that Jesse and I recently had a conversation on was, many of our students at school, you go to school for 8 hours, then by the time you get home, sometimes the schools are like, hey, you got some homework to do. And then it's, oh my gosh, max burnout. Mm-hmm. So I always try to see about getting an accommodation that focuses on content mastery as opposed to work completion. That way the student is not required to have to do homework. And that accommodation right there minimizes that nervous system stress, the demand, the overwhelm of executive functioning. And just, I try to reframe it like that. Another thing that I like to do is to try to, in the IEP accommodations page, have a safe person, someone that the student can co-regulate with in the building. Because when the student can start to work on identifying when they're starting to feel task overload, sensory overwhelm, or whatever their needs might be, then they can develop a system to go to that safe person to co-regulate with. And that's what we do in our own lives as adults, right? If we had a hard IEP, or we had a hard meeting, or we had a tough day at work, we get in the car
and go to the bar.
And then we go straight to Yard House and get a 22-ounce beer. No, full bottle of wine. Okay, I do that too, but
that's a coping skill. Put that under coping.
You're right.
I have rough days. Like, all of us are going to have rough days. Yeah. But even with, as a parent, sometimes I become dysregulated and I say something to my child that I didn't mean. I'm like, dang, I regret not saying that. But then I'll tell Jesse, she'll help me just be like, hey, look, just because that happened doesn't mean that you're not a good parent. And I separate the two. Or if I have a hard day at work, I'll call her and just be like, oh my gosh, this happened. And our students need that, because that's a life skill. And that is just things that they learn. Like, they're learning about why they have accommodations. Like, sure, they get optimal seating and or preferential seating or printed out notes, but they need to know the why. Like, this is why you have that accommodation, because your neurotype needs some support. So that way you can navigate this world effectively and meet your own needs and prioritize your own well-being.
Yeah. Yeah. The why behind it, I think, is such an interesting piece of helping students really understand their IEP and why this is being done. I think that's really rare. I don't see that a ton. Like, I'm all about talking about brains being wired differently and modeling that and all of that. But I will say, even for me right now, I'm like, oh yeah, we do need to be talking about all these accommodations and supports at school as well to help them understand.
That just reminded me of the cutest video Chris has with one of his students, where he's, okay, so what are we working on, guys? And he's in a group and they're like, self-advocacy. They know we're not just creating opportunities for them to advocate. It's like, he's very clear that this is the goal and these are the things and skills we're working on.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So the goal is not to take the autism out of the autistic child. The goal is to help the autistic child learn about their brain and what accommodations are needed in all contexts, life beyond high school. If reading becomes a challenge, then identify what types of grammar apps are out there and text-to-speech apps or whatever it is, so that way they can have that for life to meet the needs.
Yeah. So I'm curious on the sensory regulation part within school setting too, because I get in my advocacy work working with families, a lot of resistance. Like OTs often aren't doing that, or they won't give them breaks, or it feels sometimes like an uphill battle, even though we know it's really effective. So can we first talk within the school system, any tips and strategies or things that are typically written into IEPs that are going to allow this sensory regulation piece to occur?
Yeah, it's definitely something that's so often overlooked, which is crazy. But I've met so many OTs who say, I'm not allowed to write a goal that has sensory in it in the school. Like I can only focus on gross motor, fine motor, or visual motor, what activities of daily living.
Yeah.
So that makes things really challenging. What I always say to SLP is, if you have a child who has sensory differences, it's going to affect them in every aspect of their life, including communication, including all of the things that OTs and PTs will work on, including whatever they're doing in the classroom. So that's definitely something that's important to include in the accommodation so that we make sure that those needs are being met. And something that I think people often have the misconception of, okay, and I'll speak specifically to SLPs, but okay, I'm going to do sensory, or parents, we have this idea too. I'm going to do sensory, AKA, I'm going to get a bin and I'm going to put rice in it and we're going to play. And that's just our idea of what sensory activities look like. But there are so many other ways that we can support kids' sensory needs and regulations, no matter what setting they're in. I just wrote a book about to come out called Ready, Set, Connect. In that book, I have an interview with Chris. And we go through what are the biggest barriers we have to using sensory in the schools.
Yeah.
And that's like the entire, we have an entire chapter on each setting and how we can knock those barriers down. But the thing is that we think of these like sensory strategies, like jumping on the trampoline or going through a tunnel. But what we often don't think about is how can we change the environment to better support the child? How can we adjust their routines to better support them? And those are two, I like to say, three buckets of sensory I always think about. One is the strategies that kids could actively engage in. Two is changing the environment. And two is changing their routines.
Yeah.
And it could just be as simple as movement breaks throughout the day. And that doesn't have to be just one child. What kid wouldn't benefit from having 5 minutes to do a movement activity before they sit down for the next hour-long activity in the classroom? So it could be like a fun movement break where they're dancing, and or they're like, there's just so many videos you could pull up on YouTube to have kids go along with. Or it could be like, okay, everyone seems like they're a little stressed right now and overwhelmed. Let's do something for 5 minutes that's going to be really calming for the whole class.
Yeah.
And we do breathing, or we put on the Headspace app, which is free for educators. And we've been doing meditation every single night with our kids. It's making a huge difference.
It's awesome.
But there's so many ways that we can adjust what we do throughout the day, and it could benefit the entire class.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's often easy to identify when kids are like, their nervous system is overwhelmed, right? It presents a lot more behaviorally. Any tips for identifying when kids are underregulated? And we know they need to be regulated to learn in any environment. So things that you often look for there?
Yeah, I love this question because it's something we don't think about. Mm-hmm. And as SLPs, for example, we might have a child come in and they come in and they sit down and they're just like low energy. And in our mind, we go, oh my gosh, this is awesome. We're just going to chill with this chill kid. And it's going to be like the easiest half hour after running around chasing the last one. Mm-hmm. And that, just because they come in and they're easygoing, doesn't mean they're regulated.
Right.
So I think that I always say we have to think about their energy level. Mm-hmm. Like I compare Tigger to Eeyore. Are they Tigger with a lot of energy, or are they Eeyore where it's like they're there, but they're just like not fully engaged in the activity. Yes. So I think not seeing that they're really engaged in an activity, just being more of like a passive participant, having that lower energy that they're coming in with.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's so important. I actually took, Jesse, I took both of your master classes recently because I was like, I love being able to learn from different disciplines and talking about this under-regulation piece and paying attention to the amount of gestalts that are happening in terms of regulation. And I don't do in-home sessions very often, but locally I'll do a couple. And I was with a family and the nanny was like, I just can't get him engaged no matter what I'm trying. And I was like, he's underregulated. She's, what do you mean? So like I showed her like upregulating and we just saw the gestalts take off. And it's a lot of times too, it can sometimes look like disengagement or refusal and thinking they're going through some phase or something. And it's no, we all deserve to have our cups filled and at that optimal level. And I think explaining too, like big cup versus small cup and how much input kids need, I think provides such helpful language. So thank you for that. I think it's incredible.
Yeah, for sure. And it's just because we're doing play-based child-led therapy doesn't mean that we're getting the most out of the child in that session. Mm-hmm. We could be doing the most child-led therapy possible, but we're still just following a kid around the room. We've all been there. Yep. And that regulation piece is so crucial because it moves from just us trying to follow them around and figure out what's exciting for them to creating that engagement and back and forth interaction, which is how language is built.
Absolutely. So the audience of this is primarily parents of autistic kids. So I'm curious for each of you, Chris, we'll start with you. What is one thing you feel like you want parents that are listening right now to hear?
Oh, gosh. That is.
I know I put you on the spot, but I want to see like what downloads for you.
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to think.
Jesse, do you have something? You seemed like you were ready to go.
Oh, no, I was curious what he was going to say.
Okay.
But I will say, I think give yourself grace is the best thing, that advice we could give to parents, because I think that we're already dealing with enough. We already have enough on our plates as parents, and we can't possibly expect to constantly be regulated ourselves. I actually just posted a video on this. I don't know why or what inspired it, but I said, I hate telling parents to go regulate themselves.
Yeah.
Because you hear, oh, you have to be regulated to help your child, put on your oxygen mask first. And it's like, hello, we know that. And you're just making me more dysregulated by telling me that I need to focus on myself. Okay. Because when you're home and your kid is crying, you're not thinking about yourself. You are thinking about your kid. And if you can help your child, it comes back to help you. The moment you get your child to stop crying, the moment you feel peace yourself as well. Do you need to build more time into your day for self-care and all that? Of course. Of course, that's great for parents. But I also think that sometimes it's easier for us to think regulating my child also helps to regulate me.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I've been saying a lot of, and it's so simple, but I'll ask parents, like in these moments, I say, where are your feet right now? And it's crazy how much that you have to think about where your feet are, right? We don't think about our feet being on the ground, and it just slows down and it helps to quickly regulate the nervous system, not in a way that it's going to be like you're perfectly regulated, but it gives you that moment. And I think a lot of times I see parents being like, oh yeah, it just catches you off guard enough. So that's something I've been sharing with parents more, is just like, you're in the middle of it. Can you just think, where are your feet, or even where are your child's feet right now? Right. And it makes you pause for that briefest moment, even if nothing else can happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought of mine.
Yeah, okay. Let's hear.
I needed Jesse to go because I was like, okay, I need some ideas, but this has been helpful for me. So I read this book called Good Inside. It's by Dr. Becky Kennedy. And in chapter 2, I think it's titled, "There Two Things Can Be True." And that resonated with me. So for any parents out there listening, this is the concept that at any given moment, there's always multiple truths to a scenario. So for example, you yourself as a parent may have been dysregulated and got a little upset at your child for being dysregulated or something happening. And at the same time, you could still be a good parent. You could, your kid could come home and say, hey, everybody in my class has watched Five Nights at Freddy's. And then it's a scary movie. So you say, I don't want you watching that because I don't want you to have nightmares. And they could get really upset and dysregulated. Two things can be true. They could be upset and you can still set boundaries. Mm-hmm. If your kid's getting a C or a D in class and you're like, dang, I want them to have an A or a B. Two things can be true. Your kid could have a C, but also could be happy and connected with their peers. I look through that lens on almost everything, and it's really helped guide me as a parent, as a clinician, to really help separate those things and always remind myself, hey, I'm good inside. My child is good inside. That's the theme of the book. All of our kids, they're good inside. All of the things that we see externalized as behaviors, maybe it's hitting their sibling, maybe it's becoming dysregulated at bedtime every single night, maybe it's having a hard time getting up in the morning to go to school. All of those things on the outside, but on the inside, we have good kids and we regulate ourselves and we help our nervous system stay regulated. And we focus on Jesse's emphasizing on staying regulated. And then that's how we create a healthy world for our differently wired children.
Absolutely. Yeah. Kids can do well if they can. That's like right. Dr. Ross Green's whole approach. And I love remembering that as well. So before we wrap up, tell parents, each of you, where they can keep learning with you. And if I know you both focus a lot on helping to train SLPs, feel free to mention that as well. Jesse, please re-mention your book as well. But yeah, tell us where they can learn from you.
Yeah, I would love if you went and checked out my book. It's readysetconnectbook.com. And there are a lot of free bonuses that come when you buy it. So free training, guidebook, it's going to be awesome. And that's going to be great for parents or professionals. So you can find me there.
I'm really excited for it.
That's going to be amazing. Yeah.
As soon as it comes out, I will be buying it. So
yeah, it's going to be great. For me, if you're interested in a parent IEP course that I have developed or free training, or if you're looking for a neurodiversity affirming therapist, maybe it's occupational therapist, you can get that information by going to my Instagram and DMing me the word bananas. DM me the word bananas, and you'll be guided on any of those resources, whatever best meets your needs. So it's going to be bananas.
Yeah, that's so fun. I love that so much. And we will link all of that. We will link your Instagrams in the show notes. Thank you both for being here today. I really valued this time together.
Thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it. Great conversation here.
Absolutely. All right, y'all. That is a wrap for today's episode of Evolve with Dr. Tay. I will see you back here next time. Before we wrap up this episode, for real this time, I want to share a couple ways you can get even more value and what your next steps could be. First, join the Evolve Facebook group. We do Q&As about the episodes and so much more. I linked that group, my personal social media pages, and any resources I mentioned in this episode in the show notes. So scroll down now and join me online. When you submit questions on any of my pages, your question could be featured on this podcast. How cool is that? I love being able to speak on topics that feel directly relevant to your life. Your questions truly make a difference in the content we create here. One last thing, do your fellow autism parents a favor. Share this episode on your social media and tag me. Autism currently affects 1 in 36 families in the United States and many more worldwide. So I'm sure there is a parent in your social media followers that could be served by this podcast. Thank you again for being here, and I'm so grateful we shared this time together. Bye, y'all.